Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome. This is Turn the Page, Syosset Public Library's podcast. I am Evelyn Hershkowitz, Reader Services Librarian, and today I have with me
Diana Rostad here with my debut novel, You Belong Here Now.
Thank you, Diana. I am so happy to have you with us. Diana and I met through a Zoom. We were on with Book Reporter, and we were talking to William Kent Kruger about his book, This Tender Land, which I'm assuming we both absolutely loved.
He's a fabulous writer. He's one of my favorite writers. He just writes such beautiful classic novels. And so when I asked him if he would blurb for me, he just wrote the most amazing review. He said it was the best.
I have it right here. I'm gonna read it, okay?
Oh my gosh, I was overwhelmed. So I'm actually reading his Lightning Strike right now, an advanced reader copy. So I'm really excited about that. So
gotta get my hands on that. But let me just read what William Kent Kruger said about You Belong Here Now. Set against the harsh backdrop of Montana, You Belong Here Now is a novel as straightforward and powerful as the characters who populate it. I love this book, and I guarantee you won't find a finer debut work anywhere. Now, coming from him, that is just like unbelievable. What a fabulous, fabulous blurb to get. And it's also been blurbed by a lot of other famous authors also. So we're all looking forward to reading this book. I just want to let you know, if you're a Syosset patron, the book is on order. It hasn't arrived yet, but it is due out on April 6th. It's also out on our Audio Libby platform, so you can get it there when it comes out on April 6th. So for all of you listeners from Syosset, that's your best way to get the book. So Diana, why don't you tell us what the book is about?
Yeah, so the book was set in 1925 Montana, and the story really begins when these three kids from New York board this orphan train to go west. You've got a tiny girl who won't talk, an Irish boy who lost his whole family from Spanish flu, and you've got this dangerous boy from Hell's Kitchen. He's lying about his age to ride the orphan train. And so they get on this train, they go west, and nobody wants them. You know, the oldest kid, you know, from Hell's Kitchen is so menacing looking. He's got bruises on his face. They don't want him. And Patrick, the Irish boy, you know, he was spit upon. Nobody wanted him. Back then, there was a lot of prejudice about the Irish back then. People thought they were lazy. And so they don't want him. And of course, the little tiny girl, Opal, she can't even carry a bucket. So they get to the end of the line, and Charles turns to Patrick and he says, "I'm getting off this train. I'm jumping. Are you with me?" And Patrick is like, he was scared, but he went, you know. And so they turn around and Opal's right behind him and she's insisting to come too. And so that little girl jumps off the train with him and they end up on this cattle ranch with Nara and her parents. And Nara is just so brisk and hardened. You know, she's about 33, doesn't want to get married. She really wants to run that cattle operation. And she's been trying so hard to get her father to turn over the reins to it. And she looks at these kids and she's like, "I'm not going to get caught in the kitchen and, you know, wiping noses and making sandwiches." So she works them without mercy. She's really actually kind of cruel. She works them from dark to dark and she hopes they'll run off, but they don't. They actually buck up and show a lot of spirit and it surprises her. And so even though Nara's never going to be maternal, she begins to take to them. And so when Charles is jailed for freeing wild horses that were rounded up for slaughter, and this abusive mother from New York shows up to claim the youngest, Nara and her family do the unthinkable.
It's really a great story. I'm really enjoying it. It's a great book, very well written. Do you have any experience with being in Montana?
I do. I went there. My dad's whole side is from Montana. And so, of course, I did tons of research there. I went, you know, to sniff the air, and I went into the Montana Historical Society and all of those lovely places. And they have this town out there that's set up just like an old town from this time, with all of the tools and the kitchen, you know, that they had back then, and all of the steam tractors. It was really, really fascinating. And so, but the real passion for the story began, you know, when my father came to Christmas and he brought all these amazing photos of the family ranches in Montana. And, you know, there was, you know, my grandfather is maybe 3 or 4 years old, standing in these big pair of boots with chickens all around him, and these two little girls in boots sitting on the porch. And it just, all these stories, all these anecdotes that he, you know, would write on the back of the pictures, it just sort of broke open this whole wide world where I could see my characters in. And so it just seemed really natural to start, you know, basing the book off of family members. You know, Nara in the book is named for my maternal grandmother, but she quickly morphed into my eldest daughter, who was very headstrong, natural leader. She was so happy to tell you, you know, what to do, where to go. She was just, and she was brisk, you know, and confrontational. So, and she was a rule book. In fact, she went into HR. That's what she did. And anyway, she was, so Nara in the book is all about the rules. And Charles only has one rule. That's don't get caught, you know, because he's a street kid. He, you know, he's lived and died by his fists on the streets. And so, you know, when he goes to stick up for his newfound siblings in the book, I mean, he beats these kids up so badly. And this one bully, he packs his mouth because this bully is talking terrible things about Patrick and calling him terrible names. And so Charles just reaches down and just packs his mouth with so much dirt he can't talk. And then he holds it closed and he's almost choking this kid to death. And everybody's mortified. They're terrified of this kid. And, you know, to Charles, you know, I guess in this point, at this point in the book, Charles still didn't feel safe, you know? And so the family looks at this behavior and they're like, oh my God, I don't know if we can save this kid. He's really kind of broken. And so Charles is based off my son, who was 17 years old at the time. And he was very tender inside like Charles, but a fierce protector of his siblings. And, you know, the Papa Stewart is based off my grandfather, who sang all of the songs in this book. The Side Hill Gouger was a myth and a legend back then in Montana. Little Footprints in the Snow, another song in the book, is about a little girl who got lost in a blizzard. It was a true story. And then there's a song that he wrote for my grandmother at the end there. And so it's just really been a family project. My aunts have helped me, and they've kind of brought in all these old, you know, song reels and, you know, found the old lyrics. And another aunt has found all these wonderful photos, and she's always helping me with the backstory on them and verifying who's what. And then my father, of course, you know, he was my best editor. When he found out I was going to set this book on Montana, he was so excited. The first thing he wanted to do was go to the library, you know, to research. He's a great reader. And so we went to the library, but he did many read throughs for me. We went back and forth. He helped me with my fight scene, my man fight scene, which it did eventually end up on the cutting room floor. But I mean, he made it so much better. We argued over whether there was butane in 1925 and just all kinds of neat things. So it was a huge family project. I could never have done it without them.
So. There's so much about cattle and the wild horses. Yeah. I mean, did you know about all that, or did you have to actually research it?
I had to research that. There's parts in the book, the horsey scenes that are based off, you know, childhood incidents, like when Charles gets the wind knocked out of him. Charles is given that big Appaloosa called Charge, right, who is very aptly named Charge, because every time he gets on him, he takes off with him and he knocks him off and he knocks the wind out of him. And so that's that's something that happened to me in a horse incident. So, but the wild horses in the book are actually based on the prior range wild horse population. And I remember seeing pictures of them, and there was this one horse that was just an unreal color. He was blue, purplish blue. And so I looked into it, and they're called blue roans, and they're just so magical looking. And these creatures exist out there. I mean, they're more beautiful than some of the horses that we breed. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that, you know, in researching these horses and knowing sort of what is a part of this landscape that I'm in. And this is how I came to the wild horses, was I was researching Montana, and this came up on my radar, and I'm like, wow, you know. And I'm sorry to say it, but the wild horses today are in just as much danger of, you know, being wiped off the face of the earth as they were in 1925 Montana. Yeah. It's quite sad. And so there's
don't
a
let
lot
them
of,
just roam. They don't let them roam free. They
can't. No, they're rounding them up right now as we speak. It's just, it's incredible that it's happening. There's a lot of groups out there. American Wild Horse Campaign is working really hard. I know Willie Nelson's been a big advocate of the wild horse movement, and they're doing everything they can to save these horses. And my Irish boy in the book, Patrick, he yeah. comes from an equestrian background. He worked with his grandfather out at the racetracks in Ireland. And so he sees these majestic creatures and he thinks there's no way they're gonna destroy these animals, because in the book, the boys are made to round up these horses. And it's very cruel. One of the horses dies, as is very typical when you do these kinds of roundups, that, you know, horses can become terrified. The little colts, sometimes they'll even run their hoofs right off because they're just so tender. It's really, really tragic. So a lot of that's in the book. I'm very passionate about the wild horse movement. And so there's some information in the behind the book about what people can do about, you know, you can adopt a horse. We adopt dogs. We don't let them get destroyed. And there's a BLM, a Bureau of Land Management program, where you can adopt a bureau, a donkey or a horse, and they can be gentled. So
amazing what you find out when you research for a book, right?
Yeah.
Now, how did you find out about this orphan train?
Yeah. So, you know, there was this article online, and it was a CNN article, and it had all these amazing pictures of these street kids that had come from, you know, New York. And something that people don't know about me is that I used to have a caseload of youthful offenders that I worked with in South Central Los Angeles after the riots. It was basically my job to get them a job. So I worked with these kids as they were paroling. And, you know, when I saw the backstories on these orphans from New York, they were just like my kids. You know, they lived in gangs on the streets. My kids were in the Bloods and the Crips. You know, these kids had done terrible things, and so had mine. But, you know, something they very much had in common is they still had hope. You know, they still had hope. And you can see that in the pictures. You know, they're on those train platforms and they're hanging out of the trains, and you can see they're going on an adventure. You know, no matter what's happened previously, they had a lot of spirit. So I really connected with those kids from that perspective. And a lot of Charles's background is based on what I know of kids who've had to live by their wits and live by their fists, you know? So at one point I thought, wow, I feel like I'm a really good person to write this book because of that unique background.
When did you start writing this book?
Oh, embarrassingly, about 14 years ago now. So
what are some of your other careers, since this is your debut novel?
Well, you know, I told you about one, you know, that was my big girl job. I worked for the JTPA program with youthful offenders. And then I was in, you know, nonprofit work after that. And then I went over to business management after that. And then I sort of stayed home with the kids because my husband at the time was so busy. He was traveling. There was no way that we could both have a job if he was traveling all the time. So I stayed home. And you know, as my kids got older, you know, I was always a great reader and I loved history. I loved to research. And so I decided that I was going to become a writer. That was going to be my profession. And, you know, so I just dove headlong. I went to every conference I could go to. I subscribed to the Publishers Marketplace, which is that clearinghouse where you see everything that gets, you know, bought and sold in the industry. And, you know, I entered the creative writing program at Southern Methodist University, just really put my whole heart into it. And I can tell you that from my perspective, it takes a lot of tenacity, but it also takes faith in yourself, because one thing I, you know, will always remember being asked over and over again is, when is that book going to be done? Mm-hmm. And, or when can I buy it? You know, and I'm all soon.
Well, now you could purchase it and have it on April 6th, though.
That's right.
So how did you end up, what was your path to getting published by your publisher?
Well, you know, I pitched it. I kind of through the publisher's marketplace, I knew who the big, big players were, who was really successful at doing, you know, being an agent, being an editor, blah, blah. And so I found this Marley Roussoff, and I'm like, and I didn't even know she was female. She was so successful, I thought she was a man. And I actually, when I pitched to her in Minneapolis, I told her, I said, I'm really embarrassed. I thought you were a guy because you were so successful. And she goes, you know, a lot of people think that, but, you know, the funny thing about Marley is, you know, she is the kindest agent I ever met. She was so darn nice. And I'm sure that's part of the recipe, her secret for success is, you know, that she's just a really genuinely nice person. And anyway, but to get to her, I practically had to stalk her because she was very hard to get a hold of. No social media, never hardly ever pitched out to the, you know, to any of the conferences. So what I did was I put a calendar item, and every like so often I would check her website to see if she was taking submissions. And then I went a little step farther and got a little creepy and put a Google alert on her. So I started stalking her. And this, you know, and it told me that she was going to go to this loft place in Minneapolis. And I thought, well, that's funny. But it turns out that was her old bookstore. That's how she started in the business, was selling books. And strangely enough, you know, her father was a bookbinder, and she told me stories about how he had, he helped the Montana Historical Society bind books. And she used to help him bind books in cowhide for the Montana Historical Society. And so she kind of has this real love of Montana, this real kind of interest. And so it just, you know, by happenstance, all of this, you know, came together. And then, you know, I went to the Historical Novel Society and I pitched my book directly to Lucia, and she liked the sound of it. So it just came together. It took a long time. It took a lot of faith and a little bit of stalking.
Well, congratulations on your debut novel. I'm loving it.
Thank you, Evelyn.
What are you writing now? Do you have something else in the works?
I do. It's set in 1900 San Francisco. It's about this handicapped young girl who escapes her overprotective family to go find her famous mountain man father and prove she's capable of anything. She's sick of being coddled. She wants to go find this guy who's just never been in her life before. And of course, he does all these fantastic things out in the wild. And, you know, and she can't even, you know, turn around without somebody, you know, fussing over her. So that's kind of the story.
Okay. So you like strong women characters?
I do. And I really love epic journeys too.
Okay.
So yeah.
Like this Tender Land. That was a great epic journey too, right?
I know it. That was like, it, that's a real standout for me. Mm-hmm. It's one of my most loved ever. So right. Yeah. Very classic book.
Did he bring you into that book reporter thing that we did together, or?
Carol Fitzgerald did. She was so nice when she did my website, because when I had to do an author website, I asked her, I said, you know, Carol, I found you through Kent's site. I said, I loved his website because, you know, he was one of my favorite authors. So naturally I go to his site and how does he do it, you know? And so then I noticed she did his site and I asked her to do mine, and wow, she did it fast. Oh my God, it's so beautiful.
Yeah, your website is great.
Mountains and horses. It's gorgeous.
So just tell everybody how they can find it. It's just your name, is it?
It's dianarostad.com.
Okay, great. Yeah, everybody listening, definitely check out our website. There's a lot going on there. It's really great.
Yeah.
Your father, you said, lived in Montana?
Yes, his whole family comes from Montana. He was
how long did he there. Did he grow up in Montana? That's where he grew up the whole time, or did he move
away? When he was 5 or 6.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then my mother comes from the farms of Arkansas, and they sort of met in Washington as teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's great. Yeah, no, that it really portrays the land. Like, I don't know anything about Montana at all. So reading your book really, you know, shines a light on what it's like to be on. I mean, I don't know anything about farming either. I mean, I grew up on Long Island. There were farms on Long Island at one time. Now it's suburbia. It's strip malls and there's hardly any farming anymore left here. So, and the one that is local, we all love and patronize because we're just so happy that they have a farm that we can get fresh food. It's not a cattle farm or a chicken farm. It's more fruits and vegetables. But, you know, like I said, we don't know anything about it. But reading your book definitely opened my eyes to how hard the work is. I mean, she worked them really hard.
She did. She was cruel.
really hard. Now, if you weren't writing, what would you be doing now? Would you be going back to any of those other jobs or?
You know, I don't know. So my side hustle is real estate and I'm building a spec home right now with a partner. And so I do a lot of that. Yeah, so I really do some very, very different things with my time. And I have to literally have two offices because I can't mix those two things up, you know, but I'm very lucky that I get to work with my youngest daughter. She and I have a real estate team together down here in Florida.
So fabulous.
Yeah.
Right. Oh boy. So do you have any, like we've spoken to other authors and they always seem to have a book in the drawer. Do you have a book in the drawer that?
Oh yes. And he's kicking on it to get out because he's heard about this Bridgerton series set in his heyday. It's Lord Byron.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, by the time I got this novel, like really gorgeous, you know, the industry had declared biographical fiction dead. And so it's in the drawer, but who knows when it'll come out and it's there.
Okay. And another question we like to ask our authors, are you a planner? Do you plan your books or do you just do it by the seat of your pants? Which way
I pantsed Byron and it took so long to do it. And I swore I would never do it again. So I am a definite planner. When I sat down to write You Belong Here Now, what I did was I wrote a log line. And from there, I wrote like a 12-page, you know, turn by turn outline. So that when I sat down, the only thing I had to do was, you know, make the writing gorgeous, make the atmosphere, you know, really put you in that landscape. And you know, just focus on the emotions. And so it kind of breaks apart the two different things you have to do to bring a book into the world, right? You have to have a great story and a great plot, and then you also have to make it come alive. And so I've found that it's just so much easier to plan for sure, but it doesn't stop you from taking some really cool organic turns. There's right. nothing stopping you. So
right.
that's so how I do it.
So even though you plan, what surprised you while you were writing?
I think what surprised me was this this thing with Nara and Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's what surprised me.
Okay.
It just came out. It's like, boom, he's hot.
We all need a little romance in our stories, right?
Yeah, and she was a woman, you know, in her prime.
Right.
So. Exactly. And he was a handsome dude.
And I'm looking at those of us that are listening. I'm sorry that you can't see this. But she has a beautiful, huge cover behind her of the book. And it's a really great cover. It shows the train and it shows, I'm not sure if it's Patrick or Charles, and the young little Opal sitting there. It's a beautiful cover. Did you have any say in that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Definitely. I loved the landscape they put, you know, on the book. It just really, I don't know, it just brings that time alive. And they've just made this amazing video too, off the cover. That's just phenomenal. That'll come out. It'll be all over the place on April 6th. So,
Oh, the video's not out yet. We can't see it yet.
No, but it's just, okay. I mean, it's the cover video. It's just phenomenal. Yeah.
I look forward to that. I will definitely look for that. Wow. That's just great that they're behind you. They're pushing the book, huh?
They are. Yeah. Harper's been amazing. They have so many resources and, you know, it's the reason that I, you know, never really decided to self-publish because I knew that I would need resources. And I'm also not a good author to self-publish. Like I'll probably always write something. It'll feel the same, but it's not going to be like the same time or the same place. I'm not a real strict genre writer. Mm-hmm. And I think those folks do really well self-publishing, but I always knew that I just wasn't going to write in the way that that would work. And also I just wanted help. So, and they, you know, the industry is still, they can still raise up a debut author better than Amazon has not been able to overcome that. And I don't think they ever will. Mm-hmm. They just don't have the connections and the buzz. So
how have you been doing during this pandemic?
Oh, wow. You know, like everybody else, I've gained weight.
Me too.
How could we avoid it? I mean, I don't know if some of it was comfort eating or bored eating.
Mine was all comfort eating.
Oh, my gosh. And part of it is my kids got me this air fryer for Christmas, right as it hit. And, you know, tater tots just go so wonderful in an air fryer.
So does zucchini, though.
Oh, you're okay. Yeah, you're right. I got some of that, too.
Yeah. It does.
True enough. Yeah.
Well, did they at one point think that you'd be doing a regular tour, going to bookstores and all kinds of things? Or?
Well, you know, in my most cagey moments during the lockdown here, I put together this RV independent bookstore tour thing, an idea, and I floated it to Lucia, and she's like, what? A lady from Florida? And by the way, back in June or July in Florida, we were like toxic here. We had so much COVID here. Nobody wanted to go to Florida. You know what I mean? So she's all, oh no, the optics are terrible. So I've tabled that, but I am going to revive that because, you know, now that all those people bought a bunch of RVs, now they're putting them back on the market. And number one, the prices are going down. And I think with everybody having vaccinations and whatever, I think it'll be okay to do that. Maybe, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see when it's safe. But I really just wanted to get in an RV and do some writing and just go around to independent bookstores mm-hmm. and help them, you know, because I know they're hurting too. Right. And just meet people and, you know, maybe not shake hands, you know, fist bump or whatever right. it is we're doing, the elbow bump and just talk to people. And because I like to get on the road. So that was sort of my big harebrained idea, and it's still in there.
Okay, good. I hope you're able to do that. I hope we're going to be on the downswing from this virus, and all the authors will be able to get out there and go to the independent bookstores and meet their audience and their readers. And I'm hoping that happens soon. But obviously, this Zoom thing has brought so many more people to the attention of these authors. I mean, I practically do one every day, watch an author visit. I mean, it's just, I love it. Whereas before I wasn't able to do all that, but yeah. I just want to tell our listeners that you really have to pick up a copy of You Belong Here Now. It's really an excellent book. I'm highly recommending it. I will be handing it to our patrons to read. And I wish you all the best of luck with your debut novel, Diana. And I just think it's great. And I thank you so much for coming on our Turn the Page podcast. And when your next book comes out, please let us know. This is Evelyn Hershkowitz, Reader Service Librarian. And we also have with us Diana Rostad. So Diana, thank you so much for being with us. Now we're going to close the chapter on Turn the Page podcast. Thank you all for listening.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.